I'm Rick Ganley. This is NHPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. For more than 30 years, Afghanistan has seemed a broken nation, economically, politically, and especially in terms of its citizens' security. This breakdown began with the Soviet invasion in 1979 and continued up through the Taliban takeover in the 1990s. When the United States entered Afghanistan in the fall of 2001, hopes were high that the U.S. could help it become what officials called a stable, functioning democracy. But 11 years in, few Americans seem to hold those hopes. Instead, many view Afghanistan as a lost cause. Our guest today, however, is not among them. We're talking this hour with Philip Walker, an international lawyer and consultant who lives in Dunbarton, New Hampshire, and who specializes in helping conflict-ridden societies build up civil institutions, for example, systems of taxation, banking, regulation, lawmaking, and the courts. He's worked all over the Mideast and South Asia, in Syria, Palestine, Pakistan, to name a few. For the past several years, he's been senior legal advisor to the Afghan Ministry of Finance. And while Walker agrees Afghanistan faces enormous challenges, he says there is another story that's not being told, that the economy is growing rapidly and that some of those structures that help war-torn societies recover are just beginning to take root. Today in The Exchange, Philip Walker is here, senior legal advisor to the Afghan finance minister, and let's hear from you. If you have experience in Afghanistan, do you feel it's on a path towards stability, especially after the U.S. leaves, not only in terms of security, but economically and politically? Do you think that after more than a decade of a U.S. presence, Afghanistan should now stand on its own, or should the U.S. continue to play some kind of role? Give us a call, the exchange number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or post your comments on our Facebook page. And Philip Walker, it's really nice to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Laura. It's great to be back on The Exchange.
Well, just in the last month, Phil, the picture we get from Afghanistan is that everything is bad and that it's getting worse. This year was supposed to be a good year in terms of more transition to Afghan control, but we've seen talks with the Taliban break down. We've seen a U.S. soldier snap and go on a terrible killing rampage. Is there anything, Phil, good going on in Afghanistan? It seems all bad.
Yes, there is a lot that's good going on in Afghanistan. The bottom line, really, I would say the word is cautious optimism. Bad things have happened. Bad things will continue to happen. But overall, I think the trend is frankly positive. I'm not an expert on military affairs, but what people have told me is that the Afghan armed forces, while full of problems, are showing substantial progress, have taken over security in some parts of the country. Plans are on place for security transition to continue until 2014, when the U.S. combat role will end. The Afghan economy has been growing at a rapid clip for a decade now. Growth forecasts are in the 10% and above range.
Okay, wait a minute. Now, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, 10% growth, anybody would love that.
Well, consider that they started pretty close to zero.
Right.
So, I mean, we're talking about an economy that was absolutely 100% shattered 10 years ago. So we're talking about basic infrastructure, reconstruction, road, bridges, electrical infrastructure, you know, basic stuff. So it's not surprising that you would see a strong growth rate. But even beyond that, we're seeing strong increases in national revenue. The tax take has well exceeded the growth rate of the economy. There's a lot of good stuff on the horizon. It will be years coming to fruition. And this is the real challenge in the short term. The plain fact is U.S. combat role is coming to an end. U.S. troops are coming out with increasing rapidity. There will be some residual force left after 2014. The exact role is yet to be determined. The exact numbers are yet to be determined, but it will be a small mission. Eventually, economic growth in Afghanistan will allow Afghanistan to stand on its own two feet, but that's not going to happen for at least 10 years, possibly in the 15 to 18 year range. And we are looking at a fiscal gap in the short term that will make or break the experiment in Afghanistan.
I'm interested in this economic growth and where it comes from, Phil. And for sure, if you're down at the very bottom, any growth, you know, mm-hmm. is rapid and impressive. But so how much is this, though, Phil, due to rebuilding roads and bridges and so forth that have mm-hmm. been hurt by decades of conflict? How much is it based on supplying goods and services to the U.S. military and other non-governmental organizations? You know what I'm saying? I mean, if the U.S. isn't there pumping in money just to rebuild the country, what happens to the economy?
Well, that's actually a very good point, and a lot of smart people are trying to grapple with that right now, that absolutely a large part of that growth over the past 10 years has been outside money, largely military money. But that can be overstated as well. The way the U.S. spends money in Afghanistan and the way many other countries spend money in Afghanistan, most of that money goes back to the home country. You know, I've seen statistics that 90% or greater of U.S. dollars spent ostensibly on Afghanistan never touch the Afghan economy. That stays in the U.S.
Now, explain that.
Well, if you have military expenditures, the military expenditures are on salaries to American servicemen. That does not get spent in Afghanistan. You have expenditures on military hardware. That's expenditures that stays in the United States. Even in the area of development aid, U.S. procurement rules are such that a lot of money has to be spent in the United States. I mean, many development professionals decry U.S. procurement practices in the aid area, but it's a political reality that American constituencies like to see money spent in the United States.
So if my company rebuilds a bridge in Afghanistan, aren't I at least hiring Afghan workers to help me rebuild that bridge?
At the end of the road, you are hiring some Afghan workers, but you are hiring Americans first. You are buying American products and services first. You're flying on American flag carriers first. You're spending money on American security contractors to provide security on the ground first. And some money does hit Afghanistan eventually, but it's in the 10% range.
How much of the growth that we've seen in Afghanistan comes from the illegal drug trade?
Difficult to say. A lot of it. There's been if you walk around downtown Kabul, there are what people refer to as drug palaces. They are fabulous mansions in some of the nicer parts of the city.
Really?
That are just colloquially referred to as drug palaces because the assumption, rightly or wrongly, is that the individual built it with at least some drug money.
And that drug money gets recycled back into the economy.
Ironically, the drug money has more impact on the Afghan economy than a lot of the U.S. aid does.
What about the minerals, Phil? I've heard that Afghanistan, although it doesn't have oil, does have valuable minerals that high-tech companies need to make microchips and so forth. I've heard that that's a growing economic slice.
This is a substantial part of the economic future of Afghanistan, but not in the very near term. You know, we're talking 10 to 20 years out when some of those contracts, when some of those proven reserves will start to pay and some of those contracts will start to come to fruition. I mean, we're seeing some of it now. There's been two large mineral contracts that have been awarded at present. There's a third that is to be awarded in the near future. It's all competitive bidding, transparent process, according to worldwide best practice for mineral extraction. But it's slow going. And, you know, it takes years to put the infrastructure in place to start seeing results from those proven reserves. And there's still a lot that's expected to be out there that we don't know quite what it will pay.
And I'm assuming there aren't any Afghan companies bidding for these for mining of these minerals.
No,
it's mostly
international companies. The Indians and the Chinese have shown the most interest to date. It's unfortunate, in fact, that very few American companies seem to be interested in exploiting these reserves.
Why do you suppose that is, Phil?
I don't know. I think it's just the bad rap that Afghanistan gets.
In terms of
security, in terms of a place to do business. Perhaps lower-hanging fruit elsewhere. I mean, what I've seen with my own eyes is that the Chinese and the Indians are more motivated.
to get those mineral contracts.
Yeah.
Our phone number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Today in the exchange, Philip Walker is here. He's a resident of Dunbarton, New Hampshire, and an international lawyer and consultant with a special focus on the reform and reconstruction of conflict-ridden societies. As he said, he's currently senior advisor to the Afghan Ministry of Finance. Give us a call. We want your questions and comments this hour at 1-800-892-6477. Your thoughts on whether Afghanistan could be on a path towards stability. Your thoughts on whether the U.S. should continue to play some sort of a role in Afghanistan's political and economic future. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. A couple more questions about this economic growth, which again is so interesting, Phil, because we don't hear about that. Is the economic growth just in Kabul, or is it spread out across the country?
I would say it's mostly in Kabul and in the south. In Kabul, simply because as the transportation hub of the country, a lot of business activity takes place there. Also, a lot of donor-driven economic activity is there. In the south, because a lot of donor funds have been directed in the areas where the insurgency has been the strongest, in the hopes that economic assistance will help move people away from a position where they support the Taliban. Going forward, the next 10 years, if you will, I think it's very important to see economic growth spread more evenly throughout the country and donor assistance be spread more evenly throughout the country, because some of the greatest potential for growth is actually in the parts of the country that are stable and have been stable for quite a number of years.
Yeah, and it's interesting, Phil. I've read so many times that Afghanistan almost seems like two different countries. Mm-hmm. You've got Kabul, which is sort of modernizing and bustling and markets and banks, and then you've got the rest of the country.
Actually, I'd even say three different countries.
Really?
Because you've got Kabul, which is its own thing. You've got the Pashtun majority areas of the south, which have been the site of most of the insurgency. And then you have relatively quiet, but very remote and in some ways backwards areas of the north and west that are mostly ethnic Hazara or Tajik.
Behind these giant mountains.
Yeah,
Roads that are basically beaten down paths.
Pretty much. Although that is changing rapidly.
Because of the companies that are interested in mining the minerals and so forth?
Because of that, and also because of donor assistance that's gone into roads, bridges, electric infrastructure, railways.
All right. We'll talk more after a short break, Phil. And I want to ask you a little bit about your time with the Afghan Ministry of Finance. Also, we'll talk about the relationship between security in Afghanistan and the economy. We'll take your calls, too, at 1-800-892-6477.
Good morning. It's 9:19, and support for NHPR comes from UR members. And support also comes to us from Grupponi Auto Group, featuring multiple lines of fuel-efficient, environmentally friendly cars at Grupponi Auto Junction in Bow and online 24 hours a day at grupponi.com. From Tupelo Music Hall, presenting Dan Hicks and the Hot Licks on Friday, April 13th in White River Junction and Thursday, April 19th in Londonderry. Tickets at tupelohall.com. And from Granite State Human Resource Conference, Tuesday, May 1st at the Center of New Hampshire in Manchester. Information and registration online at gshrconference.org. More of a Granite Staters look behind the headlines about Afghanistan on the exchange on NHPR and a 10 on the Diane Rehm Show. It's the Friday News Roundup. New Hampshire weather today, mostly sunny for most of the state, partly to mostly cloudy from the White Mountains north. Highs today near 45 north, ranging to 55 in the south. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, a look at some progress in Afghanistan. Philip Walker, a New Hampshire attorney working with the Kabul government, joins us to discuss the prospects for a more stable and prosperous Afghan state. By the way, he'll be giving a talk at New England College on Wednesday, April 18th at 7 o'clock. You can find out more about that on our website. We invite you to join us now at 1-800-892-6477. Or send a short email to exchange at nhpr.org. Also, The Exchange is now on Facebook, so we hope you go to our page and join the conversation there. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. As Afghanistan moves into a phase where the U.S. is no longer there, what hopes do you have that it will be able to turn into a stable society? Should the U.S. continue to play some sort of role in Afghanistan's political and economic future? Again, our number 1-800-892-6477. 7. And Phil, let's go to the callers. And Robert's calling from where? Hi, Robert. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Good morning.
Morning.
So I had a question. Philip suggested that it seems that U.S. mining interests aren't going over to Afghanistan, and these contracts are being awarded to nationalized companies such as from China and India. And my question was regarding the awarding and the paying for these contracts. As I understand it, India and China have the capital, the large capital resources necessary to pay for these contracts up front, and perhaps maybe the U.S. interests don't have that type of capital available. So I thought maybe Phil could comment on that.
Thanks a lot for your call, Robert.
Honestly, I don't know why there's not been more interest from the United States. I mean, the process for bidding is a transparent one. Essentially, it's over a period of time that potential bidders are allowed to review the reserves, do what is necessary to get a sense of what they think is there, and then it's essentially sealed bids.
You know, I'm kind of surprised to hear you say that, Phil, because the process for bidding is a transparent mm-hmm. one. From what I've read, everything in Afghanistan is rife with corruption.
That is simply not true.
Really?
Yes, that is simply not true. There's plenty. I mean, I would never suggest that there's not corruption. There is plenty of corruption. It's a constant issue, and there is a constant struggle and pushback to try and minimize it. But there are some parts of the Afghan government that are exceptional, that, you know, it's really world class. Ministry of Finance, where I am, I think any government on earth would be happy to have the leadership that the Ministry of Finance has.
Let's talk a little bit more about that. And thanks for the call, Robert. What are you doing at the Afghan Ministry of Finance?
I'm at present the senior legal advisor, which means I do everything from assist with high stakes negotiations to try and sort out small money contract disputes.
And how has that worked? You coming in as an American and you're in Afghanistan.
Well, I tend to go in for 3 weeks to a month at a stretch. And when I'm home, I answer questions by phone, email, you know, whatever is necessary. To the extent that a big part of my work, at least in the past year, has been ongoing IMF negotiations, it's been quite convenient to have me in the United States from time to time because it facilitates communication and that sort of thing.
You worked on a huge project with the Ministry of Finance, the breakdown. They almost had their Wall Street breakdown, if I could put it that way, right? The Bank of Kabul exploded.
Yes, well, it did explode. I mean, and it's not so different from banking crises that took place in the United States or Europe. I mean, the essential story was that Kabul Bank was, until September 2010, the largest bank in Afghanistan with about $1 billion capitalization. It was founded by two particularly colorful characters that are straight out of central casting in some ways. One, a professional gambler, and the other, a security guard, effectively.
And they founded
They founded the biggest bank in the country. It attracted a lot of money from various investors. They got deeply into the political culture of the country. There's serious allegations of bribery and malfeasance relating to special favors done for the bank or by the bank. Leaving that aside, the bank collapsed in August 2010. After the bank collapse, it appeared that there was approximately $825 million missing out of the total billion capitalization. A lot of that can be ascribed to the collapse of the Dubai real estate market, that the bank was heavily invested in property in Dubai. And with the worldwide economic collapse, those properties lost significant value. So it's not so different, if you will, from the near collapse of Bank of America in the United States, Royal Bank of Scotland in UK. I mean, it happened in the same time frame for similar reasons, although there's special Afghan twists to this story. The government of Afghanistan stepped in at that point to secure all depositors' interest. And in fact, the central bank started paying off any depositors that wanted to take their money out. They stemmed the run within approximately 6 to 8 weeks, stabilized the situation. The bank went from $1 billion capitalization to approximately $450 million capitalization, meaning the balance got pulled out by the depositors. They took their money elsewhere, presumably. But a substantial number of depositors maintained their confidence in the bank, kept their money there. The government of Afghanistan underwrote a bailout of the bank. We signed the papers in April of 2011, and we took over the bank. So the Kabul Bank is now a state-owned bank with approximately $450 million capitalization. It's a well-run bank, solid financials, and we're looking to privatize it in June, July this year.
So that's when you got involved in helping the Afghan government?
I got involved... I was home for summer vacation when this all happened. I got involved in September, October timeframe when we started trying to figure out what to do with this mess.
See, again, that story surprises me because most of the stories that we hear from Afghanistan are about, you know, this agency that doesn't function and this bureaucracy that doesn't function and, you know, an electrical system and a water system that don't work. And it's just surprising to me to hear you say, Phil, that, you know, they had this banking crisis and they solved it pretty well.
And the two principal miscreants are in jail as we speak. And the President Karzai just yesterday made a public announcement that a special tribunal is being formed to put them on trial. And the likelihood is they're going to be in jail for a long time.
Wow. Well, again, our number for you to join us with your questions and comments about the other stories about Afghanistan that we don't hear as much is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And, you know, you mentioned President Karzai, Phil, and I do have to ask you this. Every conversation that we have about Afghanistan on this program, one theme keeps coming up. The feeling that Afghans cannot trust their government while Hamid Karzai is at the helm. He's seen as hopelessly corrupt, not a reliable partner for the U.S. What do you think about that? Does Karzai have to go?
I don't know. I have had no direct experience with President Karzai. I've had some experience with the palace and his senior staff. The phrase that immediately comes to mind as actually crazy like a fox. He does seem to do some strange things in public, but his ability to keep on top of Afghan politics is unparalleled. If you've ever read The Brothers Karamazov, there's a phrase, the galloping troika, where the rider is trying to stay on top of three horses at the same time. And that, I think, is the balancing act that President Karzai has done for the past 9 years. His term of office is up in 2014. I wouldn't want to say one way or the other whether he's the right man for the job right now. It's beyond my pay grade. But I think the challenge in 2014 and going forward is having someone in that office that is capable of dealing with the special problems of the second decade of the new Afghanistan, which are going to be the mundane problems of making the government work, getting the revenues in to cover the salaries, and keeping this growth on track so that Afghanistan does not fall back into chaos.
Well, and probably after all they've been through, many Afghan people would welcome mundane problems because so many of the problems have been just, you know, preserving your life there. But a little bit more about Karzai, you know, it's said that because he's of the Pashtun tribe, he hands out all his juicy jobs and contracts to his fellow Pashtuns, and this breeds resentment and unhappiness. I wonder what you see or hear about that, Phil, when you're working in Afghanistan.
I have found remarkably little inter-ethnic acrimony. And I've worked, as you mentioned, in a number of post-conflict societies where the inter-ethnic acrimony was palpable. And really, I've seen very little of that in Afghanistan. And it's always quite surprised me pleasantly that there are every ethnicity in Afghanistan working in the Ministry of Finance. They get along very well together. There is a certain informal set-aside. For example, one deputy minister position is always reserved for a Hazara, which is one of the smaller minority groups. And the president is sort of commonly understood to be a Pashtun, at least one vice president, a Tajik, at least one vice and one vice president, a Hazara, which is the current case. But I've not found that sort of palpable acrimony that I've seen elsewhere. In terms of the patronage that the president has or has not used, that's politics. I mean, that happens in the United States, too. But there is an interesting distinction between the first Karzai administration and the second Karzai administration. Because of the weakening political position of the Karzai administration between the two elections, and you may recall there were some questions about that elections.
Serious questions.
He secured the support of the Tajik, a substantial portion of the Tajik population, by bringing Marshal Fahim, who was a leader of the Northern Alliance, into the government. In the first Karzai administration, Fahim had been in opposition. He's now the first vice president. I'll tell you frankly, his brother is implicated in the Kabul Bank. Fahim's brother is implicated in the Kabul Bank scandal, which certainly complicates law enforcement efforts. Although it's been pretty clean. As far as I've seen, it's been pretty clean so far.
Well, and it's interesting, and you have worked in other conflict-ridden societies, and so you're not a Pollyanna when it comes to ethnic tensions.
No.
You recognize them when you see them.
Yeah. I mean, it's there, but it's not as bad as in Iraq by any stretch of the imagination.
Our phone number again for you to join us with Philip Walker is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. If you have experience in Afghanistan, what do you think about what Mr. Walker says, that there are positive events happening in that country, that the country is beginning to establish some of the civil institutions that it needs to move ahead? Do you think that Afghanistan will be able to be on a path towards stability after the U.S. leaves? Again, not just in terms of providing security, but economically and politically. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org, or you can join us on Facebook. And let's take another call. This is Christian in Westminster. Hi, Christian. Go ahead.
Yeah, geez, that was fast. That caught me off guard. Anyway, it seems to me your guest, he almost like justifies the war in Afghanistan. I don't know if he's forgotten his history about that country or what, but some countries, it's going to take the millennium for them to ever turn around any sort of a positive direction. I mean, we lose blood, a treasure over there. We lose everything. Just look at our national debt, what it's costing us. It's almost like he justifies it. The only way, that, in my opinion, is to have, well, if you're going to go to war, is you've got to use the Roman army policy, and that was a scorched earth, and nothing else seems to work.
What do you mean by that, Christian? I mean, you seem to be saying we shouldn't have gone into Afghanistan in the first place, and
definitely not.
And that's a feeling that I know a lot of folks have. But what's your second point that you're trying to make there?
My point is, it's a lost cause, and to justify it, like he claims, like for every dollar we spend there, 90% comes back to the United States. I don't know what kind of accounting this guy is using, but that's ridiculous. We wouldn't have this huge deficit if this was true.
Christian, thanks a lot for calling in. Two important points. The second one first, I think. A lot of people agree with Christian. Lost cause. That's the phrase you hear over and over and over again.
Well, I'm not in a position to talk about the wisdom of having gone in the first place. I'm at the point of simply looking at where we're at now and what is going to happen in the next couple of years. I don't believe it is a lost cause. And it may be. We don't know. What I'm seeing right in front of me is a fiscal gap that will make or break what we're doing there right now.
Again, fiscal gap
meaning
what?
More money going out than coming in. The reality is, to maintain security in Afghanistan after U.S. forces leave, the Afghans are going to need an army of 250,000 men under arms at least. And this is a current debate between U.S. and Afghan authorities as to the final number. The Afghans are actually looking more at 325,000 men under arms, whereas U.S. is looking at 250,000. And, of course, there's budget implications for that. Our internal numbers indicate that the government of Afghanistan is going to have a fiscal gap of approximately $8 billion to meet payroll in 2014, to take on all of the financial responsibilities that are currently being borne by the U.S. and the NATO allies in Afghanistan. And there are negotiations currently ongoing as to the amount that Afghanistan is going to be receiving and for how long, and also how that money is to be spent. To go back to Christian's second point about how much money comes back to Afghanistan, I mean, that's just the reality. And it's well understood that most American money actually comes back to the United States, and it's structured that way to support the U.S. economy as much as it is to support the Afghan economy. What Afghanistan is going to be looking for in the post-2014 environment is a lot more money being spent through the Afghan economy so that it maximizes the impact on the Afghan economy, so that it, so that we don't have a financial crash because of the withdrawal of aid. It should be a slow withdrawal of aid over a substantial period of time.
I see what you're saying. So now, go ahead, Phil. Yeah.
Now, $8 billion is not a small amount of money by any stretch. You know, it is not a small bill. But we currently spend $180 billion per year in Afghanistan. And $8 billion a year is a tiny fraction of that. So our internal estimates are that we will need, that Afghanistan will need an $8 billion subsidy the first year, gradually declining over time, either for a period not less than 10 years, not more than 20 years. Our conservative estimate is 15 to 18 years, and that is dependent in large measure upon the size of the Afghan armed forces, the success of negotiations with the Taliban, and the speed with which some of the revenue resources from those natural mineral deposits start to come online.
Well, and you're touching on Christian's point, which is, you know, we've got a deficit here, mm-hmm. and you're saying, look, right now we're spending $180 billion, so $8 billion to help the Afghan government make that transition financially isn't as much as you think. I wonder, though, how hard a case that is going to be, Phil, to make to the American public, given that so many are so sick of our involvement there. Mm-hmm. And like Christian, they view it as a lost cause.
Absolutely. And that's a political decision that Americans need to engage with. But my point is simply that it's not hopeless by any means. There is a lot of possibility, but we need to be realistic about what can happen in what time frame.
How hopeful are you that that investment will come through?
Again, given cautiously optimistic. It's not going to be zero, and it's not going to be the current level of expenditure, but Afghanistan is not looking for the current level of expenditure. The NATO meeting that will take place in May in Chicago will go a long way towards determining what the final number is going to be, because that's when the decision will get made as to the size of the Afghan armed forces going forward. And the donor pledging meeting in July in Tokyo will probably be when the final number appears.
All right. Well, thanks for that call, Christian. Our number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange@nhpr.org. And we'll be right back.
Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday, doesn't shy away from the big questions.
So does America need to produce more scientists and engineers?
Okay, let's talk about
signs of an early spring, that we humans have more in common with gorillas than we think. And where does the dark energy live?
I'm Brady Carlson. Join me as I sit down with Ira to discuss scientific questions of all kinds. We'll be at UNH Durham on May 1st. For tickets and information, visit nhpr.org.
This event is sponsored in part by Nathan Wexler and Company.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Southern New Hampshire Medical Center and Foundation Medical Partners, working together to design healthcare around you, where you live and work, snhmc.org. And from Waste Management, with a reminder to practice the 4 R's wherever possible, reduce, reuse, recycle, and recover the resource. Additional information at thinkgreen.com. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Monday in The Exchange, a look at the skills gap in New Hampshire. Some manufacturers say they have trouble finding qualified workers for their many job openings. Email us your questions before the program at exchange@nhpr.org. And be sure to join us Monday morning, live at 9. Today in The Exchange, some of the untold stories behind the recent dismal headlines from Afghanistan. We're sitting down with Philip Walker. He's a Dunbarton resident, international lawyer and consultant. Currently, he's senior advisor advisor to the Afghan Ministry of Finance. The number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange at nhpr.org. Also, we're on Facebook. You can go to our page and join the conversation there. And Phil, just before the break, we were talking about a call from Christian who, again, has a sentiment that many Americans share, which is why dump money down the rat hole? Let's just leave and forget about Afghanistan. Time for them to stand on their own, not our problem. What are the politics of Afghanistan and this transition here in this country?
Well, I think a big part of it is how the money will be spent going forward. It is, at least in policy circles, expected that there will be continuing financial support. And one question I think that's out there is how much of that money is going to be put through the Afghan national budget and how much of that money is going to private consultants? And
American consultants.
And I think it's very important that the lion's share of money going forward go through Afghan national structures for several reasons. Number one, it's far less expensive and more cost effective, because if you bring in a foreign company to do a job that could be done domestically by the Afghans, you're talking about foreign fees, you're talking about major security commitments. I mean, 40 to 50% of any budget of anything that gets spent in Afghanistan goes towards security, which is not necessary when you're going local. Furthermore, when you put money through national structures, you're strengthening those structures. So you get a double benefit. You both get the road or the bridge or whatever we're talking about, and you also get the capacity inside the government, or in Afghanistan at any rate, to do that job. And the concern about corruption or malfeasance is
actually much
overblown. It exists, absolutely, but the structure is in place where there is substantial international supervision of any expenditures that take place on the government of Afghanistan budget. I'll give you an example. A lot of aid that goes through the budget of Afghanistan goes through what is called the Afghan Reconstruction Trust Fund, which is a trust fund established by the World Bank. It is monitored by World Bank auditors. The money is very well accounted for. If there are problems with the expenditures or problems with the procurement, then it gets kicked back to the World Bank auditors, and the World Bank will come down hard on the government of Afghanistan.
All right, let's take some more calls, Phil. And again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Jerry's been waiting in Nashua. Jerry, thanks for hanging on. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, Laura. I have so many comments. I just don't know where to start. So, without rambling on, I would like to make a couple. I absolutely believe that it is absolutely hopeless in that country. Afghanistan has been rated as one of the most corrupt countries in the world. And when I hear that corruption is overblown, what about all of the senior officials that have shuttled money out of the country? In fact, they caught one of them with suitcases full of U.S. currency trying to leave the country. The supposed advances with the military, there isn't one battalion in the entire country that is combat ready, not one. And the comment about the people who form the bank out of central casting, they aren't out of central casting. They're absolute crooks. And to compare it to the failure of the banks in this country is ludicrous. The banks in this country failed because they made dubious investments. They didn't fail because they shuttled all the money out of the banks to their political cronies. And it's just amazing. Maybe I'm on another planet, or maybe your guest is. But to me, it's just ludicrous.
This picture is too rosy for you, Jerry, sounds like.
Really. And the comments about that the U.S. companies don't want to compete for the minerals, the reason they can't compete is because the Indian and the Chinese companies are state-run, and they're willing to pay premiums to establish the mines there, where the U.S. companies have to compete because they're competitive,
right,
and they have to have a profit. So,
Jeff, thanks a lot for calling in. Yeah, what do you think? You know, you're being a little Pollyanna-ish here,
well,
Jeff seems to be saying.
Well, I'd try not to be. I just genuinely don't think that it's as bad as the media likes to portray sometimes. As for the whether or not the guys who started Kabul Bank are crooks, I mean, that's currently in litigation, so I'm not going to just sort of say they are or they aren't. But fact, they're under indictment. Fact, they're sitting in jail. So the Afghan authorities think these guys are crooks. They agree with you, Jerry. And the challenge is now getting the money back, which has been difficult, frankly, and could be better. And that's going to be a fight for several years coming. It's going to be in litigation in numerous jurisdictions. As for
corruption, why invest in this country when he says, you know, people are just enriching themselves?
Yes, there is corruption. There absolutely is corruption in some places. I can, without starting to name names, some ministries work a lot better than others. A lot of the corruption that has come to light is not in the core government systems so much as it is individuals using their positions for personal gain by exerting influence where they really should not be doing so. And this is a constant struggle. And, you know, people have to make an unbiased assessment as to whether they think it's worth continuing to invest or not. What I see with my own eyes is a troubled situation where there is hope.
Well, Jerry, thank you for joining us. And let's go to Heartland, Vermont, where Richard's on the air. Hi, Richard. Go ahead.
Oh, hi there. Thanks for having me on. Happy
sure.
Friday to you. I think I may just want to reiterate a point that an earlier caller had had made about why. And with all due respect to the expertise and the knowledge that the gentleman on your program has this morning, you know, it's just very, very difficult to listen to your program in the face of so many domestic problems that we are facing in our country. I'm just a hardworking American middle-aged guy with kids, looking at health care costs that have quadrupled in the last 5 years, looking at rising tuition costs spiraling out of control, the foreclosure debacle in our country, unemployment, the list goes on, and to sit in my car, and I love your program, and again, a lot of respect for the guy on the show today, but to talk about a country on the other side of the globe where we as a government, unsupported by the populace, are going to pour another $8 billion into infrastructure for the Afghani population. God bless them. But what is the point? Period. And thank you for taking my question. I will take your answer off the air.
Richard, I really appreciate you calling up. Thank you very much. And again, he, I'm sure, is not alone. The United States has enough problems. You know, let's just leave Afghanistan to itself.
Look, as a taxpayer, I am very sympathetic. I have watched some U.S. money be spent very badly in Afghanistan over the years, and I don't like it. I don't like it at all. But it's a simple question. Do we want to let Afghanistan collapse, or do we want to keep some skin in the game? And bottom line is, if we cut them off cold next year or the year after, then the place will collapse, and the $1 trillion that we've already spent is thrown out the window. If we keep some amount of financial assistance going in there, it will not collapse, and it will probably continue to move in the right direction. I say probably because you don't know for sure. Second point, my sincere hope is that that $8 billion will not all come from the United States. We actually do have a coalition in place. Not all forces in Afghanistan are U.S. forces. A lot of financial support comes from some of our NATO allies and elsewhere. And what I would like to see ideally is a little bit more equitable burden sharing between all of the countries that have a continuing interest in Afghanistan.
Now, what about that IMF agreement that you
yeah.
have been working on recently,
mm-hmm.
Phil? How does that play into this scary transition time that you are outlining?
It is critical. It's critical in a couple of different respects. First of all, it does give Afghanistan a line of credit that it can draw upon if it needs to in an emergency. In fact, right now, Afghanistan does not need that line of credit, but it's nice to have it there. Second is the IMF does provide important technical assistance, and Afghanistan gets a lot of benefit. In some respects, the financial structures in Afghanistan are very good. They are rated quite highly by the IMF. We would have had that agreement in fall 2010. It was pushed out by a year because of the Kabul bank crisis, and they put conditionality on the Afghans that certain things had to happen, including the bailout of the bank, which I previously described as a precondition to having an agreement in place. The third reason that it's important is the IMF agreement is sort of the economic and financial good housekeeping seal of approval. When we are under an IMF program, that tells the rest of the world that certain core macro fiscal structures meet the IMF minimum standard. And once Afghanistan meets that minimum standard, it opens the door to assistance from other countries. Afghanistan lost $70 million in donor assistance last year because we were not under an IMF program and the donors withheld funds that they would have otherwise put into Afghan national structures.
That's a good analogy. Yeah. The IMF agreement is sort of like the good housekeeping seal of approval. This is scrutinized. It's working. And if it isn't working, we're on it.
Yeah.
Here's an email that just came in from Randall, who says, like our earlier caller, that he thinks you're overly optimistic about Afghanistan's future growth prospects. But here's Randall's question, and it's an interesting one. What does Mr. Walker see as the source of future growth in Afghanistan? Most economic growth requires energy, and Afghanistan already faces a significant electricity shortage with no immediate prospects for much new capacity. Mm. Imports are already at capacity, and the Shaburghan, pardon my pronunciation, gas power plant and any significant new domestic hydro capacity is years away. I don't even think of Afghanistan as a hydropower place. It seems like a pretty dry place.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting question, Randall. Thank you.
That is a fabulous question. It's right on point, and it deals with some of the most difficult issues that are being faced right now. The politics of Afghanistan in some ways is driven by diesel fuel. The price of fuel in Afghanistan determines to some significant degree the possibility for future economic growth. Right now, most fuel comes in from Pakistan. There are at times 20-mile-long traffic jams of tanker trucks entering Afghanistan. As U.S. forces draw down, that fuel crunch is going to be diminished somewhat, so that helps the picture a little bit. Also, there's energy resources starting to come online from some of the other neighbors. But he touches on an absolutely critical point. And one important piece of the Afghan economic future in the next 10 to 15 years is the Turkmenistan pipeline, the so-called TAPI pipeline.
Right, right.
And those are ongoing negotiations. Whether they actually come to fruition remains to be seen. But the general idea is there are substantial gas reserves in Central Asia that need to get to markets in Pakistan and India, and the pipeline has to cross Afghanistan.
So that has not been built yet.
That has not been built yet. The negotiations are ongoing. If the negotiations come to a satisfactory conclusion, that will be a substantial financial resource for Afghanistan because there'll be transit and transport fees accruing to Afghanistan for the flow of gas. Secondarily, under the proposed agreement, Afghanistan will take some of that gas. And the anticipation, our economic plans are that the gas that we take under the TAPI agreement will go primarily to electricity production.
Interesting. So that pipeline, in addition to the fees and royalties and whatever that it brings in, will also bring in energy resources to the country itself.
Yeah, I mean, that will be a big part of whether Afghanistan is economically viable 10 years out or 20 years out.
So your optimism, based on that, based on what you've seen working with the Ministry of Finance, Phil, based on the possibility of these minerals yielding lots of money because, again, the high-tech industry is growing and they need those minerals. But you know this better than I do. Obviously, if the country's not secure, you can't run around and make all sorts of great business deals if you're hiding in your house because you can't go out. The big question that so many people are asking, what happens to the security once the U.S. leaves? I mean, it's already bad. Does it get better once the U.S. leaves? Because in Iraq, and you've worked there, some people said, actually, when the U.S. leaves, the Iraq might be safer because the U.S. presence is a flashpoint. But other people said, no, once the U.S. leaves, you know, Iraq is going to plunge into bloody chaos. What about Afghanistan? What do you think happens to the security once the U.S. goes?
Don't know. Can't say.
Yeah.
The bottom line is, this is a gamble. You know, I don't want to be a Pollyanna. I'm not going to say, oh, things are going to be rosy. We could do everything right and the place still collapses. It is a gamble, and U.S. policymakers at the end of the day have to assess their tolerance for risk and willingness to stay in the game. If they have no tolerance for risk, they got to get out and just accept the consequences, which is the place will collapse. My assessment is the place won't collapse so long as we stay in, but I could be wrong.
And stay in this limited
stay
fashion.
Stay in this limited financial capacity. Because I think the real drive is the money, not the security. The security is bad. Absolutely. Parts of the country are unsafe. They are far safer than they were 3 years ago because of the surge that was ordered by President Obama shortly after he came into office. Whether those gains remain in place, this is the million-dollar question. How solid are those Afghan forces that will be replacing U.S. and other forces progressively? It's hard to say. I think the withdrawal of U.S. forces, it cuts several ways simultaneously. U.S. forces absolutely stiffen the resolve of the Afghan forces, and with them gone, we could see a relaxation of discipline or some units falling apart, that sort of thing. That happened in Iraq as well. How much it happens, I don't know. It will happen, but to a limited extent. One point that should be remembered is that after the Soviet Union, and I hate to draw this comparison, but after the Soviet Union left Afghanistan in 1989, it did not collapse immediately. The Najibullah government remained in power for a significant period of time, and it only collapsed when the Soviet Union withdrew its financial support. Bottom line, if the government of Afghanistan can pay the salaries and stay solvent, the place probably won't collapse.
Well, Philip, good to see you. Thank you for being
Thanks.
Here. That's Philip Walker again, New Hampshire resident, international lawyer and consultant who is currently working with the Afghan Ministry of Finance. He'll be giving a talk about that Kabul bank story at New England College on Wednesday, April 18th at 7 p.m. You can find out more at our website, nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.